Hebrews 11, and I start reading at verse 32. And what more shall I say? I do not have time to tell you about Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, who through faith conquered kingdoms, administered justice, and gained what was promised, who shut the mouths of lions, quenched the fury of the flames, and escaped the edge of the sword, whose weakness was turned to strength, and who became powerful in battle and routed foreign armies. Women received back their dead, raised to life again. Others were tortured and refused to be released, so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and ill-treated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, and in caves and holes in the ground. These were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. Therefore, since we are surrounded by such a great cloud of witnesses, let us throw off everything that hinders and the sin that so easily entangles, and let us run with perseverance the race marked out for us. Let us fix our eyes on Jesus, the author and perfecter of our faith, who, for the joy set before him, endured the cross, scorning its shame, and sat down at the right hand of the throne of God. Consider him who endured such opposition from sinful men, so that you will not grow weary and lose heart. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God. One thing in common with the person who wrote that I don't have time either to tell you about all those people, Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets, and all the others that get described. Well, have you ever felt like giving it all up? Have you ever been tempted to pack it all in, this business of being a Christian? Most of us have at one time or another, when things get too difficult, when the cost seems too great, when the profit and loss seems to get out of all proportion. Or if we're not tempted to give it up entirely, maybe we're tempted to take it easy for a while. Not to take it quite so seriously, ease up a bit, take the pressure off ourselves. Or maybe there are some here at the other end of the process that haven't even started out on a life with Jesus Christ yet. And as you wonder about it and consider it, and you're wondering, will it carry my weight? Does it carry weight intellectually? Does it carry weight existentially in my life? Will it work? One of the things that holds you back is the cost. It seems there's too much to give up, you sometimes think. There's not enough to gain, profit and loss again. And then there's the pressure it will bring. You wonder if you'll be able to sustain it, and you wonder whether you really want to sustain it. Well, this chapter in Hebrews, and we are back in Hebrews, sorry, I forgot to tell you that as we began, page 1280. I think it was 1280, that's from memory. 1210, close. Not close enough. Page 1210, Hebrews chapter 11, the last bit. I think this passage, this whole chapter, in fact, is for any who've been in one of those situations, or are in one of those situations, or will be. And if you haven't ever been in that situation of feeling like giving up, and you don't think you ever will be, then you still need to listen, because this will tell you how to pray for the rest of us who are normal. It was the beginning of April when we began the series, so it might be good to remind ourselves who it is that the writer is talking to, and try to hear the passage, hear what is being said, as they would have heard it in their day. We don't know a lot about them. Unlike most of Paul's letters, the letter to the Hebrews doesn't begin with greetings from so-and-so to so-and-so living in such-and-such a place and so on. So it's a very general letter, but what we can gather from the contents is it's particularly written to Christian believers from a Jewish background. That's why it's called to the Hebrews, Hebrew Christians from that religious and cultural background. They would have been the first generation of Christian believers. Nowadays, they're the people who would be probably want to call themselves Messianic Jews. They're still Jews. They're still born into the line of God's chosen people. But Jews who have come to a faith in Jesus as their Messiah, the Anointed One, the Christ. And no doubt that these Messianic believers back then claimed, as they do today, that this had not made them less Jewish by following Jesus Christ, but more fully, more completely Jewish than they'd ever been before, because they had encountered the one to whom all their religious background was pointing, the one who fulfilled all their religious background. But life hadn't been easy for them. And we get a glimpse of that in the previous chapter. Just turn back a page, at the bottom of page 1208. Listen to what things have been like for them, and it seems still are to some extent. Verse 32, remember those earlier days after you had received the light, that is, turned to Christ, when you stood your ground in a great contest in the face of suffering. Sometimes you were publicly exposed to insult and persecution. At other times you stood side by side with those who were so treated. You sympathized with those in prison and joyfully accepted the confiscation of your property because you knew that you yourselves had better and lasting possessions. So it had been pretty grim for them, and it still was to some extent. They were under a lot of pressure, not to give up on religious faith, but to give up on the Christian bit and go back to their old Judaism, to pack in the Jesus stuff, or at least to take it easy, to keep quiet on that, not to mention it in public. And they were under a lot of pressure from their own Landsleute, from other Jews, to give up on Christ in one way or another. And in fact, the whole of this letter, all 13 chapters, is the attempt of the writer to persuade them not to do that, not to go back, but to hang in there with Jesus. And we hear that again in the next little bit in chapter 10, the last bit of chapter 10, verse 35 onwards. Do not throw away your confidence. It will be richly rewarded. You need to persevere, keep pressing on, so that when you have done the will of God, you will receive what he has promised. For in just a very little while, he who is coming will come and will not delay. But my righteous one will live by faith. And if he shrinks back, I will not be pleased with him. But we are not of those who shrink back, that's a zurückweichen. We are not of those who shrink back and are destroyed, but of those who believe and are saved. So that's a bit about who this letter was originally written to. People under great pressure to shrink back, to zurückweichen, or just the word could also be translated as a hold back, to draw back, to turn back in one way or another. A pressure they faced. It's a pressure that we face in perhaps rather different forms. On the whole, we don't face active persecution as they did. Ours tends to be of a more passive variety. Social exclusion, if you take your faith too seriously, certain people don't want too much to do with you. We're treated perhaps as if we're nutters. There's even sometimes discrimination in the workplace. That didn't end with the GDR, I'm sure. But quite often the pressure is from the inside as much as it's from the outside. There's the fear from within of what others may say or may think about us, so we prefer to keep quiet. There's a sense of missing out. We may find in our workplace, whatever, we don't seem to prosper as much as those around us because we're living by different standards and certain practices don't happen and we don't knife other people in the back to get their job and so on, as might happen with others. And we begin to sense that because of our approach and because of our attitudes as a Christian, we're missing out. And there's the voice inside us that says it wouldn't matter too much. In fact, it might be rather fun just to step outside the limits God has set from time to time, just for a while. And then let's be honest, sometimes the hormones get a bit out of control. We fall for someone who's not our husband or wife, or someone who's not a believer and doesn't share our values. And any of those pressures might lead us to pack it all in. Or simply to put our walk with Christ on the back burner, to take it easy, not to be too consequent, so that we don't give up the believing, but we give up the living. And I may be wrong, but I suspect the longer we've been a Christian, the less likely we are to pack it in completely. It's become too much part of us. We've had too much experience of God in our lives to be able to throw it overboard and say that's all nonsense. We know that wouldn't be true. So instead, the danger is the take it easy approach. Believe it, but don't live it too much. And maybe we get to a time when the temptation is to look forward rather than back. I don't know if any of you experience that, but sometimes I find my temptation is not to press the rewind button and to say I want to go back to pre-Christian days, but I want to press the fast forward button. I just want to get it all over with. I wish Christ would return tomorrow and get it sorted out. And in the meantime, I want to just put my feet up and take it easy. So what's the message to people who are tempted to take it easy, to pull back or shrink back or draw back, whatever? What has the writer got to say to those who are feeling that pressure? Well, as you may have noticed, this chapter, as we've been working through it, it's a bit like a Madame Tussauds exhibition on the Old Testament. It's got all the characters of the Old Testament recorded. It's just he's doing it here in words rather than in waxworks. He's taken us through a whole lot of pen portraits, little pictures, word pictures, to tell us and remind us of all these characters in the Old Testament. The main difference from Madame Tussauds is that these guys are all the good guys, so they've all still got their heads on. They're not perfect. They get things wrong along the way. But overall, they were the good guys who lived by faith. They didn't shrink back. They're all people who pressed on. They're people whose outlook and actions were encouraged to imitate. But as I mentioned in the children's talk, by verse 32, the writer is out of time. So the next lot, after he spent a bit of time on some of the great well-known figures of the past, the next lot get just a brief mention by name, but no detail: Gideon, Barak, Samson, Jephthah, David, Samuel, and the prophets. And then there's a whole group, we don't even get their names. We just get certain events that are associated with them. But that's not the only division here between those who are named and those who are unnamed. There's another dividing line in this list. It's not as obvious, but it's actually more significant. It's in verse 35, where the first half... Sorry, it's in verse 35. In the first half of this passage from 32 to 40, the first half is about people who come through their trials not exactly unscathed. They have some wounds along the way. But at least they're in one piece, and in some sense, they win victories with God's help. judges win their battle. Samuel and David, as I said, see great things happen in the kingdom. And that positive note continues until the middle of verse 35, as I said. Women receive back their dead, raised to life again. Reference to women, probably to widows under in the times of Elijah and Elisha. But see if you can spot the change as I read on. Others were tortured and refused to be released so that they might gain a better resurrection. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned. They were sawn in two. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, presumably not fashion items in those days, but a sign of poverty. Destitute, persecuted, and ill-treated. The world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains, in caves and holes in the ground. Do you see what the difference is? For these people, it never came good in their own lifetime. Either their lives were cut short by the persecution, or they carried on living, but as outcasts, as losers, pazaga. They were never successful. They were never restored. They were never vindicated. They weren't even famous. We don't even know their names. Now, you do sometimes come across Christians who try to tell you that if you've got enough faith, then your life will be a breeze. You'll go from success to success, from victory to victory. You'll prosper in all you do. It's all a question of having faith of the right quality and the right quantity. You pray in faith, you claim the prosperity that God has promised you, and all will be well. Life will be a breeze. And the preachers who proclaim that message are usually very consistent. They are consequent. They do live what they believe. You can see it on some of the satellite television channels, I'm told. I don't get them, but I'm told they're there. You can see from their clothes and their rings and their hairstyling that they're very wealthy. And behind the scenes, when you read about them, they have a number of very expensive cars and homes, perhaps a yacht or a private plane, all because they claimed it in faith and God made them prosperous. Well, here's a chapter which has been about faith from the beginning to the end. And how does it end? It ends with a list of those who did not prosper, people who were losers in the world's eyes, who died as martyrs or as outcasts. And what should we think of them? Are we supposed to say they didn't have enough faith to claim what God was going to give them? Had they missed the boat? 39. These were all commended for their faith. God didn't see them as failures and losers. He thought they were the business, and he had something better planned for such people, together with us, as he goes on to say. And in the New Testament, in a sense, you can often recognize a true believer, not by how much success and prosperity comes their way, but how they cope when things go badly. I think it was John Wesley who said, about the early Methodists. They weren't Methodists in those days because they were still Anglicans when John Wesley was alive. They became a separate church later. But he, I think, said of his people, "Our people die well." When faced with the ultimate test, they cope. In a church I know of, a leading member was very ill with cancer. I actually don't know what the final outcome was. And the church was rightly praying fervently for this person to be healed, and very much seeing it as an attack of the evil one, and that God needed to be vindicated by this person being healed, and that would be the great miracle. And there was one meeting I was at, I had this very strong sense, maybe God will be most glorified if this man does go to glory and people see how this church copes with it. In other words, how the Christians cope with the ultimate challenge of death may be far more glorifying to God than the dramatic miracle of healing. Because we're not promised prosperity and success. And the test is, how do we cope when difficulties come? We've been doing John's Gospel in the evening, or part of it. Here's one verse from chapter 12, which reminds us that the true follower of Jesus Christ treads the same path that he trod. Whoever serves me must follow me, and where I am, my servant also will be. His path wasn't one of comfort and ease and luxury and prosperity. He wasn't successful as the world measures it. But he pressed on rather than shrinking back, and we're called to do the same. So as we take a last look today at this picture gallery, let's get things in perspective. Having a hard time isn't a sign of failure. It's a sign of being where Jesus is. So we may need to take our fingers off the rewind button or the fast forward button and say to ourselves, you're not the first to be going through a hard time as a follower of Christ. Anyone else want to turn their phones off while we take a break? Say to yourself when you're finding the going difficult, you're not the first to be going through a hard time as a follower of Christ. You're not even going through the worst experience in terms of the hardships Christians have faced down the years. And you certainly won't be the last. It's actually part of the scenery for a follower of Jesus Christ to walk where he walked. So what did give these believers that are mentioned here and throughout the chapter the strength to keep pressing on even when it was difficult? And the simple answer is faith. That's the answer that's given here, although that's a little bit of an insider word. It's not the word we tend to use that much in everyday life. So I'm going to talk about trusting and believing, which are also translations of the same Greek word. And just two points. What kept them pressing on? The first was, they believed that this world is not all that there is. And we see that the second half of 35. They refused to be released so that they may gain a better resurrection. Well, it's not entirely clear exactly what that meant, in what circumstances that was, but it's clear that they believed there was something better to come, the other side of resurrection. And that belief gave them strength, the resilience to hang in there when life was tough. They were convinced that this world that we see and touch and feel isn't the sum total of reality. There's more to it than the eye can see. There's a better world beyond the grave. And it wasn't just a sort of nice theory stored up in their head. It was a belief which shaped the whole way they lived. It affected their values, what was important to them, how they lived and behaved. But on its own, that's not a great comfort, believing that this world is not everything. Because you might believe that there is resurrection to another life, but you don't know whether that's going to be to something positive or not. What if the next world is even worse than this one? What if you rise the other side and you discovered you're on the kitchen team, or whatever, the one that no one actually wants to be on? You're not considered worthy. What is it that transformed this future beyond death from a place to be feared to a place to be excited about and look forward to? And the answer to that is the second key thing that helped keep them pressing on. They trusted God to keep his promises. They trusted God to keep his promises, and he had made promises about the future. We know from other bits of the Bible this was true of all the named characters, and we can assume it was true of also the unnamed characters. They based their actions, sometimes very specific actions, sometimes the action of a whole life, on what God had said. If God had said it, they treated that as a promise, they took him at his word, and they did it. You may remember last week, by faith the walls of Jericho fell, and we remembered the people of Israel. They must have felt a right bunch of Charlies as they walked around the walls 6 times, making lots of noise, and nothing happened. But they kept doing it because God had promised, if you do that, I will provide the victory. And they did it, experienced God doing that. That made it easier for them next time around, didn't it? Because they'd experienced God looking after them. Not so easy for those who died before they received what had been promised. 39, they were commended for their faith, yet none of them, this last group, received what had been promised. And yet they still obeyed, and they still walked God's way. You might want to put it like that. We sometimes have to trust the God who can, even when he doesn't. We sometimes have to trust the God who can do everything, even when he doesn't do exactly the thing that we're after or hasn't done it yet. And that's why patience and perseverance is needed. That's why it's not easy to keep pressing on. But we can keep pressing on if we trust God that he will one day deliver on his promises, and especially the great promises to remake us, to restore us to his image as originally intended. And finally, we remember the great advantage that we have. Verse 40, God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. And that's back to the main theme of the letter. What is it that we have more of that is better for us? Jesus Christ, simply. Jesus Christ and all he's shown us of God and all he's done for us in his cross and resurrection. Jesus and the message about him are far better in every way than anything they had before in their previous way of life. And that'll be true for us as well. So where are we heading? We're heading to a future with God that's made possible through Christ into eternity. But the temptation now, the pressure now, will often be to shrink back, not to press on, not to live it to the full, but just to believe it vaguely. And what we need to keep remembering is to believe that this world is not all that there is, and trust God to keep his promises, to look after us now, yes, but ultimately to fulfill his purposes in our lives throughout eternity. May God make us people who press on and don't shrink back.